But you know, I'm kind of grateful actually that I don't have like detailed recall of they weren't like very awesome days to want to remember all the minutiae of. I am thankful to not have memories of the sounds of my bones breaking.
Welcome to the Blister Podcast, a program dedicated to interesting people, the great outdoors, and a bunch of other stuff we like. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, the founder of Blister, and you can check us out online at blisterreview.com. If you are listening to this, there's a decent chance that you spend a good bit of time outside, and it's also possible that outdoor activities make up a large part of your self-identity. You are a skier, or a climber, or mountain biker, or runner. So what would you do if all of these outdoor activities were suddenly taken away? And more than that, what would you do if you were suddenly paralyzed? Well, that actually happened to our guest on today's podcast, Jim Harris. As you'll hear, Jim was as involved in the outdoor sports world as anyone, and he was quickly making a name for himself in the industry when a fluke accident and serious injury threatened to take all of that away. But that accident is by no means the end of the story. It's actually where the story really starts getting crazy. For the past several years, Jim has attacked his rehab, and he is in the midst of, to use his own words, a crazy recovery. Jim is now once again lifting, mountain biking in Moab, and basically doing the seemingly impossible. If you want to follow his adventures, and you absolutely should, you can find Jim on Instagram at Perpetual Weekend. This podcast episode is about a remarkable person with a remarkable story. And beyond that, this is a podcast about self-identity and perspective. I promise that if you listen to it, you'll see what I mean, and I'm confident that you will be the better for it. If for no other reason, then you will have gotten to meet and learned a thing or two from Jim Harris. Jim, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm good. And where are you today?
I am sitting at my house here in Carbondale, Colorado at the moment.
Okay. How long have you been in Carbondale?
You know, I moved here just about a year and a half ago.
Okay. And why Carbondale?
I was offered a job working for a film festival. So I came and worked, spent a bit more than a year working as program and creative director for Five Point Film Fest. Forget to like screen all the submissions and pick the films to the festival, which was that was a cool job. It was a cool way to be connected with that kind of adventure creative community.
That adventure creative community that you have been a part of for quite a while now, right? We were just talking a little bit ago about that maybe when you first headed to Montana, is that where you would kind of locate or start that identification?
Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Ohio and then moved to Montana when I was for college, for university. So I moved to Missoula and really gravitated to like all the outdoor sports that all the mountain sports that were available there. Oh my God, it is hailing like crazy here. Sorry, distracted. It's like being, it's like one of those like
biblical plague.
It's like those state lottery things with all the ping pong balls like bouncing around. Anyway.
I've definitely never heard hail described that way. So thanks for that.
Like there's all these little, I don't even know what, little, not quite marble size hail, but large enough that I'm really glad I'm inside at the moment. Just like ricocheting off all the roof off the neighbor's house. And anyway, totally distracted.
That's okay.
Yeah, so moved to Montana and I really liked the culture there. Like really liked all the very DIY approach to being involved in the outdoors in a way that culture doesn't exist in nearly the same way in the Midwest. Like there's an awful lot of emphasis on like spectating, like sports spectating in the Midwest, but yeah, a lot less participation. In Montana, there was less participation, more like, hey, let's all go do this thing and then we'll tailgate afterwards, versus like starting Saturday morning with tailgating.
Yeah,
so I really enjoyed that about Montana. And that led me to be pretty quickly within was already interested in skiing, but within a few months of moving to Montana, got a beacon and shovel and probe and started ski touring a bit, and then got more and more interested in more difficult objectives and overnight winter camping trips and ski hut trips to British Columbia. And after university, I moved to Colorado and worked for Outward Bound and did outdoor ed stuff, and then started doing guiding work and teaching avalanche classes. And then somewhere in there, with some Outward Bound friends, in 2009, we went on this big backpacking trip in Alaska. And we walked across the southern half of Wrangell St. Elias National Park, that is part of this, it's the U.S.'s largest national park. Mm-hmm. It's one of the largest contiguous preserved areas in the world. Like, if you include the national park and preserve and the park that's on the Canadian side of the border, the whole thing is like bigger than Switzerland, bigger than Vermont. Like, it's a big chunk of land. So anyway, we went and walked across the park, and I took a bunch of photos on this this kind of fancy point-and-shoot camera that I was dorking out with. Like, had like manual controls, but it was definitely pretty small and compact. And so I came back from this backpacking trip, posted all these pictures on the internet, and this thread on TetonGravity.com totally went viral. Where it got like tens of thousands of views for like a backpacking trip. And I ended up registering a web domain and reposting the trip report there. And it kind of continued to go viral. I think people posted it to Reddit, and it made it like to the front page of Reddit on two different occasions, and like would crash my little WordPress site. And from that trip, I got introduced to some pro skiers in Salt Lake. I was living in Utah at the time, and somebody was like, hey, we saw this thing on the internet and that looks really cool. Do you want to come to Alaska with us? And that was like literally how I got an invite to go to this remote part of the Alaska range. And so I bought a $500 SLR, bought a Canon Rebel camera and like a kit lens, and went on this ski trip with pro skiers and like wrote a story and had no idea really how the publishing world works. So I sent like a DVD of photos plus like a printed out manuscript in a manila envelope to Powder Magazine. And they were really psyched about the article. And I think Derek Taylor, who was the editor at the time, later told me that he thought I was like a 50 or 60 year old man, because like nobody sends them things in manila envelopes. And he was like, he thought I was an old guy. Cause Andrew McLean was one of the people on the trip was, like in his like late 40s, early 50s. He's like, oh, I thought you were like Andrew's age. And, but yeah, that kind of opened the door into the publishing world for me. And pretty quickly I went from, being a ski bum who was like doing guide work in the summer and waiting tables and tuning skis and things in the winter, to doing, photo and writing work full time and year round.
And sorry, what, what year was the manila envelope submitted?
It's like 2010.
Okay. And by the way, that's so fantastic. And I think this probably stands as a good bit of advice for like young people without experience trying to crack into an industry. Just submit whatever you're going to submit in a manila envelope, and you probably get like some, wrongly assumed 10 years of experience. This is probably, true. I think this could really help some young folks out there.
I mean, that wasn't like a totally naive thing on my part. Like, I figured that as someone who had no, firsthand rapport with anybody at this magazine, that like if I just sent an email, it's no one's going to look at it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I figured like that maybe sending a physical thing, that somebody would actually open it up and like spend at least 3 or 5 minutes with it, maybe, versus like, you know, open an email and click away within 10 seconds.
Yeah, I like it. That's really smart.
That was the strategy. So I guess it worked.
It did work. It was really effective. This is like the best tip I've learned on this podcast, I think. So that was 2010. So I have this framed, when did you get to the University of Montana? That was
2005.
Okay. So we kind of went from zero to 100 over a five year.
Sorry. 2000. I graduated in 2005. I moved there in 2001.
2001. Okay.
I apologize. Yeah. Okay. So I spent 2001 to 2005 in Montana, and then spent about a year in Crested Butte, and then moved to Park City, Utah.
Okay.
And yeah.
Okay. So going back to 2010, I mean, at that point, you're an industry guy. You're doing media. You're writing. You're taking photos. I mean, are you at this point? You're like, yeah, this is just kind of what I do, and I'm making it work.
I mean, I feel like I had the reasons it was able to work out for me was one, because University of Montana has really inexpensive tuition, so I was able to graduate without any college debt, and that allowed me to go be like a dirtbag and make, you know, under $20,000 a year doing like outdoor ed work and still be able to like pull it together to live in a ski town, and live like, you know, like a full on mountain dirtbag lifestyle. And so after a few years of that, I feel like I was pretty comfortable living frugally. Yep. And so, by the time I got like that first check from that article, and then right around the same time, I got hired for a commercial lifestyle shoot for a big for a large brand that was like pretty much out of the blue, and it was definitely, I'd never been on the set of an actual photo shoot, much less had ever done like any kind of lifestyle shooting. But all of a sudden, I got offered like this, like a commercial photo day rate, which I think was like $1,500 a day or something like that. And all of a sudden had a 5-figure check from that week that, I was like, oh man, I'm not going to go back to waiting tables this winter. Like I can, if nothing else, I can totally coast on this check like for the next 4 months or 5 months. And, if I can set up another commercial photo project, just like this one in that time frame, then I can just, if I can do this like 3 times a year, I'll be making just as much as I was working like 5 jobs. And, so that was kind of the ways that worked out for me, because it certainly, it really wasn't until like right before my accident that I felt like I was actually making what most people would consider like a decent living. Mm-hmm. But because I didn't have overwhelming debt, and because I was, you know, already acclimated to living inexpensively, was able to pull that off for a handful of years.
Yeah. I mean, sounds like that's tip number two, right? Like, I mean, this is great. Like, I think for people listening to this, people wanting to maybe, you know, get into or figure out how to play a role like in the outdoor industry, and whether that's through writing or photography or a combination of both. I mean, one, manila envelopes, and then two, I mean, you know, yeah, not taking on a ton of debt, and then, you know, and or being really good at living really frugally frees you up to go pursue some of these things that are going to take time, right, to be discovered, to get better at the craft, two pretty important things, I think. Aside from the manila envelopes and living frugally, I mean, were there any other, like, what is the, like, last bit maybe of best advice? Is it just the tenacity card? Is it the getting repetitions? In your experience, what was maybe, you know, or was it just live frugally and use manila envelopes, or did you have a third?
I mean, I think some of the things that were, that worked out for me in that situation. One is that, I think one is that, that I came to that media work from, like a background where I'd learned like institutional standards for like glacier travel and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that having that technical background was a huge, which really, that was a thing that opened the door for me. And like, I was not getting invited to do these things because I was the best photographer, best videographer. I was getting invited to do them because they're like, ah, this guy is pretty good and he won't slow us down too much.
Yep.
And I think that technical background was really the reason I got invited to do things. And I think the reason that I like even attained mediocrity with that kind of media work was that it was stuff I really cared about and really enjoyed. Yeah. And I think one thing, like I think that that comes through in photographs, especially like across somebody's body of work, if they're doing something they really care about, that that seems to almost always find an audience. And I don't know, but and I see, like, I feel like in the Instagram world, there's, as like the whole brand influencer culture has become a thing,
yep.
There's so much media that's being created that is what I would be considered kind of pandering, where people are spending a lot of time up front thinking about what's going to get likes, what's going to be like the most palatable. And generally that means people are like looking to what else is, what has already got the other images that have gotten a million likes on Instagram and trying to recreate that. And I think that that sort of like catering too much to your audience, I think has, there's some like pitfalls to that around it being like fulfilling work and around even finding an audience if you don't have one yet. I don't know, that it's like a weird paradox thing, I think, for most creative pursuits, where it can be really difficult to trust your own taste and your own judgment, especially when you don't see that like, you know, lots of other people are doing this thing that you, that seems like pleasing to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like that must be something that you've dealt with. With doing it with Blister,
yeah,
where they've created gear reviews that are in depth and analytical and critical in a way that nobody else was doing, and I can't imagine that's. It must have felt weird thinking that maybe there wasn't going to be an audience for it, that it was going to be too nerdy for people,
yeah.
And that bridges are going to be burned with manufacturers and people providing the gear. And obviously that's not been the case, but I feel like that's you've certainly created a niche that didn't seem to really exist from what I can tell prior to Blister.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in our case, the lighthouse or the directive was, what would it mean to build this the right way?
Mm-hmm.
And then every possible thing we did was trying to live up to that, to answer that question, right? Can we create a company and a publication where everything we do is to try to have it done the right way? So that is pretty easy, right? And that's subjective, and you can debate, you know, different ways to then how best to accomplish that mission statement. But that was the clear directive in our case. And then I didn't really care what anybody else thought, right? It was like, this is our best collective sense, the people involved with Blister, about where we should be going and what we should be doing. I imagine maybe that's a bit different, though, than more of the kind of individual artist, right? Who is like, whether they are involved in writing or visual arts or, you know, painting or photography, because then it's maybe less about what is the right way to do this. And it's now more about you know, what am I passionate about? What's the story I want to tell? How do I want to tell those stories? I don't know if you see those two things as more similar or different.
I mean, I think there's some similarities there. I don't think that I had, it would have been really hard for me to articulate like an overarching goal about how I want to do the same thing something that's similar to what other people were doing, but do it better and do it my own way. Cause I'm not sure that I knew what my own way was to start out with. And you know, that trip report about that backpacking trip was something that I think really catalyzed a lot of thought for me.
Yep.
It was like, why? It was something, because I think it was partly because I was so blindsided by it. Because it was something like that I cared a lot about, because I just had this really formative month-long backpacking trip. I mean, we walked across a mountain range that had never been traversed before. We were like the first people to ever walk through it, across it, over it. And so that was, you know, it was this really powerful experience for me, but I didn't really expect that was going to resonate with other people. I just kind of like posted this thing on the internet thinking it was going to have a small audience of people, you know, that I knew from like real life, but didn't necessarily see very often.
Yeah.
And instead it found like there was some pieces in it that resonated with a much wider audience. And so that really caused me to question what it was that what pieces of it or what combination of things, you know, why that captured people's attention so in that way. Cause it's like, oh, like there's something here that's working. I'm just not exactly sure what it is or how to recreate it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I feel like it kind of, and part of kind of finding my way toward, you know, stumbling my way towards being able to do that consistently was an awful lot of kind of just like blind faith that there was something in the style and setup of the way I was working, like taking, you know, a lot of expedition travel with fairly minimal camera setups, and that maybe there was some combination of kind of throwing oneself into hard situations without a very clear plan of like what the media outcome was going to be.
Yeah.
And coming back with something that would have been hard to predict up front, but then it ended up being really potent at the end.
You know, I do want to get to this, you know, so we have you in sort of 2010, 11, 12, we've heard this part of the story and it sounds like you're sort of doing your thing and making it work. And then you've mentioned this accident and, I believe is it 2014?
Yeah. In, November of 2014, two friends and I had received a grant to go put this expedition together to ski across, Patagonia's ice cap. And so we had planned about a 350-mile ski and pack raft traverse through a really remote region of Chile. And we'd probably spent like a year getting organized for this trip. And we'd traveled all the way to Chile and we had, we bought snow kites right before the trip. So these brand new snow kites, I'd never even flown this particular model. And I really wasn't very good at like flying snow kites, didn't have a ton of experience with them to begin with. So just before the trip began and like the last days of prep while we were down in Patagonia, I was flying a snow kite in a grassy field in like running shoes and got picked up by a gust and slammed down. And I'm not even exactly sure what the sequence was or how it happened, but I managed to break 7 vertebrae, and like regain consciousness in this grassy field and realize that I couldn't feel or move anything from sternum down. So I spent about a week in a rural hospital in, Chile before I was able to get evacuated back to the States. And then I had a surgery to fuse those broken vertebrae and within a few weeks started noticing these small neurological changes where muscles that weren't firing all of a sudden, you know, like after a few weeks of not being able to move anything, I could like, you know, pick my heel up off the bed like a half of an inch. And it, like muscle control was really weak and kind of like flickered in and out. But these nerve pathways started turning back on and reconnecting themselves, or function was being maybe rerouted through other pathways that weren't damaged, but that were used for different functions before. So then I spent about 7 months in hospitals, most of that time at Craig Hospital in Denver. From really early on, High Fives Foundation reached out, and was like, you know, anything you need, we're gonna help you with your recovery. And so they're an athlete-based nonprofit out of Truckee, California, founded by a skier who overshot a table and paralyzed himself about 10 years ago, and then has been on a mission to help with recovery costs for athletes in similar situations. Yeah, so like through between Craig Hospital and High Fives Foundation, I've had like in my family, I've had this tremendous support network that's really enabled this just crazy recovery that I've had.
Crazy recovery, I think, is a great way to put it.
Yeah, like one of the big sort of determining factors in whether or not someone might recover from a nerve injury is how quickly that nerve tissue gets decompressed. Because brains and spines are both inside these bony enclosures, right? We've got a skull or a spinal column around this really soft, pliable nerve tissue. And so whenever there's any kind of bruising or damage to that nerve tissue, body's response is to that area to swell, and that swelling cuts off blood flow, and that lack of blood flow kills the tissue. So that swelling in these confined bony structures is kind of a counterproductive body response. But because of that, one thing that can really determine the outcome is how quickly people get decompressed. So for like traumatic brain injuries, they will, if it's bad enough, they'll just like fire up a little saw and take a big chunk out of somebody's skull, let their brain expand outside of where their cranium would allow it to, and then as the swelling goes back down, they like Humpty Dumpty them back together. And when that happens fairly quickly, the outcomes tend to be pretty good. And so for, you know, spine injuries like the one that I had, they're usually moved right to the very top of the surgical priority list. Mm-hmm. So if you have an injury like mine in an urban area in North America, you're probably going to be in surgery in like 6 hours or less. My surgery was like 8 days after my accident. Oh my God. So I think from that single data point, I don't think there was a whole lot of hope for my recovery. That, you know, doctors would look at that and be like, oh, this is just like too far out to really, for there to be a chance of anything changing.
So, okay. You went real fast over those initial days in the hospital. And at that time, were you aware of what you just spelled out? An injury like this, if surgery is undertaken immediately, chances are good. If you're waiting 8 days, that's a different story. Were you aware of that at the time?
I think that kind of came to my attention. Awareness. Yeah, it came to my attention sometime in that first week. There was some debate. There was an orthopedic surgeon at the hospital that I was at who I'm not sure he'd ever performed a surgery, like a spine surgery, but he wanted to he wanted to try. And so I had to weigh the pros and cons of potentially being operated on by a surgeon in a foreign country, who probably wasn't very familiar with the procedure. And so kind of through that, there was like trying to communicate with people in the U.S. and trying to figure out, if I was in the U.S., what would be the course of action that U.S. surgeons would take, and how does that compare and contrast with what's being offered in Punta Arenas, Chile. And I opted not to be operated on there, I think by the time I made that choice, it was already like 2 days or a day and a half after the accident, and kind of based on feedback, whatever tissue isn't getting blood flow hasn't been getting it now for like 2 days, and that a surgery, 48 hours out might not be that much. There might not be a reason to rush at some point.
Yeah.
It was kind of the conclusion.
What was your state of mind like on that? Were you like, holy cow, like maybe the biggest decision of my life, and I really don't know, do I take the red pill or the blue pill?
It's interesting, like in hindsight, that time frame, those days feel so compressed in my memory. Like it doesn't feel like it was, more than a week or a week of laying there in a foreign hospital. But I mean, I was hooked up to like drip morphine, so that probably had an awful lot to do with it. But I just bought a new iPhone just before, like weeks before. So this is like brand new iPhone that, one outcome of this accident is that my like thumb typing has gotten way, way faster. So it's been weird to I could look back and all the emails that I sent during that week in lying on my back in the hospital bed, with holding phones straight up, over my face and typing, trying to help to coordinate my evacuation and things like that. And for somebody who was drugged out of his mind, I'm like, oh man, I sound fairly articulate. I have no recollection of writing that, but it actually I'm surprised that I was
that coherent. Whatever.
Yeah. That coherent. But I'm kind of grateful actually that I don't have detailed recall of, they weren't very awesome days to want to remember all the minutiae of.
Yeah.
I've talked to other people who have had, have broken their necks and unlike me, didn't knock themselves out in the process.
Yeah.
They're described as hearing their bones break and lying there and waiting, in the 15 minutes it takes their friends to realize that something's wrong, lying there and feeling just helpless and being very aware of what has just happened. And I'm really glad that I was regained consciousness and knew I was concussed and knew I was paralyzed, but was pretty spun. I am thankful to not have memories of the sounds of my bones breaking.
Yeah. Boy, I don't even know how to fast forward this story. I feel like we could just go sort of 10 hours on the next, the next days and months. I think, and a big part of why I wanted to have this conversation is, look, I think a lot of people listening to this, I think there's a lot of us who are a whole lot like you in terms of the things that we are passionate about, the kinds of environments in which we are choosing to spend our time, the kind of pursuits that we're doing. And, frankly, I think this is a pretty damn morbid thing, but I feel like we are in a culture of, we see people that are, getting after it in the mountains and tragic things happen, right? And every one of us knows we just lost another skier or mountaineer. And social media blows up and there's a lot of, this person was an inspiration. I think one of the things, as I've sort of from afar watched you and your trajectory, you're someone who we are watching in real time, to use your phrase, have this sort of crazy recovery. An accident that took away, at least for a time, the things that, the pursuits that you probably loved most in life. And, but here you are, and we're watching you sort of come back, and it's nuts. And I don't have a smarter thing to say about that, but I wanted to talk to someone who has experienced this, because it sure as hell seems like there's going to be a perspective here that would be of value to the rest of us.
Prior to my accident, I spent like a fairly good chunk of an average week in some kind of like flow state feeling, or some kind of like flow activity like that, that really plugged in, kind of in the moment feeling that you feel when you're skiing downhill or mountain biking, where your kind of your frontal lobes of your brain shut down and you're making decisions without like reanalyzing those decisions as you're making them. You're like, oh, tree on the left, dodging right, like things just happen. And that's a really rewarding feeling. You get all these, I mean, people talk about like the Midwest culture I grew up in, people are like, oh, you're an adrenaline junkie. But I always felt like that never really never described me. I'm not like a hucker of cliffs, or never like base jumped. I've never jumped out of a plane. I feel like I definitely like action sports, but I felt like the things that I was that felt like so compelling to me wasn't just the adrenaline. And kind of after being hurt, I felt like I was cut off from all the ways that I knew how to get to that really rewarding feeling, you know, like that runner's high kind of experience. And it was a few months after my accident, and I was in this hospital in Denver, and there was an hour a day that was set up. It was a wheelchair class, where it was like how to navigate obstacles in a wheelchair. And as somebody who had ridden like bike trials in high school, I was pretty familiar with the idea of like, how can we screw around to like, how can I ride my bike up these stairs or over this thing? And all of a sudden I was like, how can I get my wheelchair up these stairs? So there was like some transference there of like, okay, I can see how this could be like a mental game. And all of a sudden realized these wheelchair classes, like that hour would just fly by. And I remember that happening, being like, oh, that was like, I just had this like flow experience from doing this, you know, from like wheelchair class. And that was kind of surprising to me. And so it's been interesting to try and kind of pivot to find other, if that's that is a feeling that still feels really meaningful to me, that like kind of that sort of mind state. So it's been like challenging and cool to find other ways to tap into that aren't, you know, like skiing, biking, sex, really high stimulus, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's been trying to find that through art and like a daily meditation practice and things like that has been rewarding. I think I would still, if I could just have a do-over and go back to the life I was living before, I'd probably still opt for that. But I feel like my quality of life now is continues to be pretty good despite all this crazy accident and all the changes that have accompanied it.
You said might choose. Mm-hmm. Might choose to go back to it. That's fascinating. Are you familiar with a book called Stumbling on Happiness?
I'm not.
It's by a Harvard psychologist named Daniel Gilbert. And I would encourage just everybody to read this book. It came out a number of years ago, but the premise of Gilbert's book is that we are all horrible predictors of the things that will truly make us happy. And we are equally horrible predictors of the things that will make us truly unhappy. And one of the things he spends time talking, I think over a couple of chapters, about injuries, you know, where as a healthy person prior to, you know, or seeing someone who's experienced an accident or an injury, oh my God, I wouldn't be able to cope. I couldn't handle that. Mm-hmm. Right? Well, you just said, yeah, I might prefer to go back to the way my life was prior to this accident. But I like my quality of life and the new challenges that I have in front of me. And I think there's something remarkable there. And I think it's interesting that, again, what you just said and the things that Gilbert presents a lot of evidence to is, you know, many of us think, my God, I couldn't handle that, or that would be horrific. And you're like, dude, there's new challenges. There's other things. There's ways to find, you know, the challenge of finding that flow state again. It's definitely one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I didn't have to, cause you offered it.
Well, I mean, I think that's interesting that you latched on to the word might there, because I think, one thing that I've noticed, you know, since immediately after my accident, people started coming forward, to share their stories of their like life-changing injuries and illnesses. And one thing that is just like so common, it's a cliche, is people saying, like, literally every single person who, you know, who comes forward to like empathize and share their story is like, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, but I wouldn't change it if I could. And I remember just being like, oh, F that. Like, yep. I would change this in a second. Like, yeah. Are you kidding? Like, yeah, there's some moments of this where I can appreciate the challenge, but it's, but I feel like for a long time I'd joke about that specific thing about like, oh yeah, everybody says they wouldn't wish on their worst enemy, but they wouldn't change it if they could. And it's like, oh yeah, I would totally change this. Like, I want to hit the command Z button.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess it makes sense that the more distance I get from my accident, the more invested I am in like my current life pursuits, and the less in the forefront, like the things I did before feel like, I don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much one of the big reasons I live in Carbondale, Colorado, and not Utah, where I was for like the 9 years prior to my accident, is that I don't have a pre-injury past here. And here in Carbondale, people only know me as this guy who showed up walking, you know, with two crutches all the time, like a year and a half ago, and now cruises around with a limp, but is otherwise going on like long mountain bike rides and,
yeah.
You know, getting more involved in the community. Like there's no like before after comparisons for me to make here. And I feel like hanging around the Wasatch, it can be really hard for me to not endlessly be comparing in my own head, like how it used to be. And like, yeah. Oh man, we used to like, I remember when we used to be up there on top of that peak for sunrise, you know, to shoot photos and blah, blah, blah. And now I'm looking at it from the parking lot or whatever. I don't want to be somebody who lives in the past that way. And as much as I love the community, and the mountains and the recreating in Utah, it can be hard for me to push all of that, all those memories out of the forefront sometimes.
Where is your preferred place for people to be kind of following you on your ventures these days? Is Instagram, Facebook, where?
Yeah, I feel like Instagram is kind of the social media platform that I use most. My Instagram handle is Perpetual Weekend.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're talking about like, yeah, back when I mountain biked, and it's like, dude, you're mountain biking. Like, yeah, this is the crazy part. Like, yeah. I mean, and you were just posted recently, right? You were, I don't know if it was Porcupine Rim, but you were riding Moab, right?
Like, oh yeah, yeah. No.
And I'm sitting there freaking out watching. I'm like, dude, get away from the edge. Like, you're a little, I'm not comfortable with how close you are to the edge of that cliff there. But, I mean,
I went and rode Porcupine Rim. It was whatever road Hazard Down from below Hazard Down.
Yeah.
And it was like totally casual. And then the next day we went and rode Mag 7, which is, you know, like Bull Run to, what used to be called Blue Dot Trail to Portal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that portal in Gold Bar Rim Trail are freaking burly. And those that ride used to be one of like my like very, very favorite rides anywhere ever prior to my accident. And it was like it was an illegal trail until like the year before last. Since it's only been legalized since my accident. And so I've driven shuttle for friends doing that ride and been like, well, that's probably something I'll never do again. And then like, I won't say I didn't walk like the hardest bits. I definitely did. But having said that, I freaking rode like, I don't know, 90, something in the high 90% of what's a really difficult trail.
Yeah.
But also just like freaking stunning, just such a cool experience. So I'm really grateful that mountain biking, I feel like I'm much more capable on a bike. But if like, you know, hiking and things like that, my right side's weaker than my left. So like right leg gets tired and I start stumbling and falling and it's hard for me to go for long hikes, but I feel like on a bike I can, like even when, you know, one leg gets super shaky and tired, I can kind of keep going. Like it doesn't totally destroy my balance, the way it does, you know, when you're on foot.
Yeah. What has this recovery looked like for you? I mean, has it felt like the progress has been pretty linear, or has it been like ton of plateaus, then this bit of a breakthrough, back to a plateau? What's that looked like since 2014?
I mean, in the medical world, the understanding is that neuro recoveries kind of tend to be logarithmic, where recovery, whatever recovery happens for people, tends to happen fairly soon after the injury, then it slows over time. And you know, according to surgeons and insurance companies, after about 2 years after a neurological injury, whatever disability you have at that point is what you're going to probably have for life, which is kind of a depressing idea until you start talking to people who have actually dealt with this. And every single person I know who has one of these, a neuro injury, talks about like the unexpected changes that happened, you know, years and decades after their accident. And so anecdotally, there's a lot of evidence that recovery goes a lot longer than 2 years.
Yeah.
And I guess as far as like how linear it feels to me, like it's, I feel like, yeah, there was probably like that first 6 months of rehab where I could like, from pretty much a week to week basis, I could feel that I was making progress. And then as that has like, as that progress has slowed, it's been actually like social media has been a really cool way to kind of have all these like different data points along that curve, because from like a day to day in the trenches existence, it can feel like I'm not progressing. Like it just, it's not something I try and like fixate too much attention on, but, like whether or not I'm making progress versus like doing things that just doing the things that theoretically should help me recover. And not maybe trying to measure it all the time, but I feel like the, like social media has been a cool way to measure it, where like all of a sudden it seems to happen. Like all of a sudden I'll have like this breakthrough where I'll like realize I'm capable of doing a thing that, you know, been inching towards closer towards in these little increments, but all of a sudden when I can do it, it feels like this very like, you know, kind of this epiphany sort of moment. You're like, oh my God, like cool. I can, I don't know. One of the more recent ones from this spring was like realizing that I can jump. And I mean, my box jump right now is maybe a foot. Mm-hmm. But you know,
but there's a box jump.
Yeah. But 6 months ago it was like having the coordination and strength to like get body weight, to like break free of gravity. It was just like, not even close to being feasible. And now it is. So it's things like that. Like, I mean, sure, you know, there's been like a million little day by day progressions of getting stronger. That wasn't something that happened like in a binary way, but I feel like my appreciation for my recovery kind of happens in like these, like with moments like that. And I feel like social media has been interesting way to kind of like, celebrate those, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you pick up new sort of role models after the accident? I mean, were you looking around and you're like, I'm fucking paralyzed in this bed? And over the next several weeks, has this been kind of about, you know, you're dealt this very particular hand and you got to go figure out what kind of gains you personally can make, not what somebody else did or how they did it? Or was there this sense of like, were there anecdotes coming in about, oh, this skier or that mountain biker or, you know, some person in a car accident, these were the gains they made. Maybe I can accomplish some of that too.
Yeah. You know, there was like an awful lot of messaging, towards people who are freshly injured around like a lot of this kind of like rah, rah, like you can do everything you used to do. Kind of like hospital propaganda. It's well-intentioned and, there's certainly some truth to that. But at the same time, there was an element of it that felt a lot like bullshit to me. I was like, remember watching hospital propaganda of some like teenager in a wheelchair, like bragging, like, I never have to buy new shoes. And I was like, oh, yeah. F that. Like, I don't want that to be like my why I'm psyched for life, because I get like good parking and don't have to buy new shoes. But you know, so something kind of counter to that, something that was really meaningful to me was a man who had been a student in an avalanche class I'd taught, reached out, and like a year after we had a course, this avalanche class together, he was, had a spine injury and was paralyzed for a while and had relearned to walk. But, in this letter he wrote, you know, he was no longer backcountry skied. He was no longer running and mountain biking, but instead he'd gotten his pilot's license and he'd gotten really into fly fishing and he had this amazing drift boat and a bunch of friends who were psyched on flying and on fly fishing. And he'd like, through this process, he'd met a woman and got married. And he was like, you know, my life is much different now than it was like 4 years ago before my accident, but life is still really good. And I reread that letter a lot because there was a lot of meaning in there to be this like, okay, like there's that. It felt a lot more honest to say like, okay, you know, I don't probably not going to have the exact same life that you had before, but, that doesn't mean it necessarily is going to be like worse.
Yep. Different isn't necessarily worse.
Yeah. It takes some, certainly takes some like creativity and an open mind and things and like probably just some time to be able to like, you know, I'm sure probably anybody who's been through a divorce will probably have a similar outlook.
So what are you most either obsessed with or passionate about today? Is it these, I mean, you know, again, as somebody on the outside watching this remarkable recovery, you know, we're seeing these moments of like, I'm like, man, damn it. The dude's fucking mountain biking porcupine now, you know? And is that the stuff when you're waking up, you're like, can't wait to see where I can push things or make progress today? Or is that more kind of like, dude, that's my routine. Like we're still working on some of that, but my head and my passions, my interests are really actually directed over in this other area.
I think, I don't know. I think my interests are like, I have not been done any ski mountaineering since getting hurt. Yeah. So yeah, I'd say like my interests have shifted a lot. I think the kind of outcomes and the things that I look for from those, the things I get obsessed about, that tends to be an awful lot of overlap in the things I take away from them. I definitely miss skiing a lot because it checked a lot of boxes for me. Like it was like had the athletic challenge and then all this, mental challenge around planning and prep and, you know, communicating with partners and having this really intense working partnership around like logistics and avalanche stuff. And then on top of that, just like all the social, like the social scene and the validation that came from being good at that. And like it checked an awful lot of boxes. I don't think I've found anything that replaces all the roles that skiing had in my life. And so that's something that's like still kind of a pretty melancholy feeling for me. But, you know, I've gotten more and more involved in art stuff in the last, especially in the last half a year. I bought a printing press, so I've been making a bunch of relief prints. Been making a living as an illustrator for like the last 6 months, and had my first solo art show recently. So that's been a cool thing to kind of like throw myself at with the same sort of like, and with, you know, similar tenacity, I guess. And yep. Like, yeah, I don't think it's like, it doesn't feel like it fills the role that skiing used to have in my life. Or at least not yet,
not yet.
It does seem like, something I'm psyched to get more and more involved with.
Where can people go to see your work, or can they yet?
Oh man.
Come on, man.
I know. I've registered another domain and have a built web store that has zero inventory posted.
Okay.
No, it's been really flattering and really cool to experience this demand for art and illustration work. Like the photo video stuff was such a hustle. Like it was really not until just in the months leading up to my accident that I felt like clients were coming to me for photo and video jobs. And like kind of that last year of doing the outdoor adventure media stuff, I feel like I had a lot of work coming my way. But you know, the handful of years prior to that were just a total hustle and a lot of me scrounging for work and for like the next paycheck. And the illustration stuff, I feel like I have yet to get a real online portfolio because I keep being offered more and more projects. That's been I would not have ever guessed or foreseen that there was going to be the sort of demand that I've experienced.
Pretty cool. So you,
yeah, but we
can't see your stuff because it's all.
Oh, there's an Instagram social media account at Gorgeous Storm, and there's a there's a built but not fleshed out website at gorgeousstorm.com. But yeah, for right now, I feel like Perpetual Weekend on Instagram is probably the best spot to follow along.
Okay. So we've don't have much time left here, but I want to ask you then about, I always just love asking people books, movies, music, visual arts. You can answer either like right now in time, which of those genres are most important to you? And then I'm also kind of curious, like, have those been the same genres, like whether it's books or movies or music, visual arts? Has that also been true of the last year or two or three?
I'd say, you know, I've gotten way into like the personal development, AKA self-help sort of genre in the last handful of months. And that sort of came out of like, I was really depressed at the end of 2016, where I'd had like kind of this like combination of life events where it felt like sort of all the points of stability started disappearing at once. And like this existential angst that I think a lot of people in my situation feel really soon after their accident, for whatever reasons, I was able to like kick that can down the road for 2 years. And kind of at like the 2 year anniversary of sort of like between a breakup and being laid off and like a Trump election and like 10 other things, like all in like the same, you know, week long period or so, it's just like kind of got thrown into this really, kind of this despairing mind state for a while. And it felt like a pretty dark place for a handful of weeks. And then at some point it seemed like, it was going to end one of two ways. And one of those was going to be one of those was going to be a really, it was going to be a bad ending. And so one outcome of that has been like a lot of kind of self-development and journaling. And I feel like I've always kind of enjoyed trying to be self-analytical, but I don't know. There's been a lot of reading to try and find new tools and ways of thinking about it and ways of accomplishing that.
Do you have any top suggestions?
I think two books that I think are kind of almost a cool couplet, almost like sort of in a left brain, right brain way, are a book called Flow. Let's call it Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, by Mikal, man, I don't even know how to say the dude's last name. There's way too many letters and consonants. Mikal C. Flow the Psychology of Optimal Experience.
Yep.
And then another book called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. Mm-hmm. And Power of Now is like super woo-woo. It's a westernized take on a combination of Eastern religions that kind of hinges around this idea of being present. And I feel like that sort of woo-woo stuff is a little bit harder for me to take in than the more sciencey outlook of the book Flow has. But you know, my reading these two side by side, I'm like, oh man, these are like, this is talking about the same thing. This is like two different ways of thinking about and describing the exact same phenomena. And I think both those books have been helpful in helping me to understand why I enjoy some of the things I enjoy, and then trying to figure out what other activities, what other passions and pursuits might check some of those same boxes.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll post links up on the show notes on the site to this episode to some of those books, and maybe that Stumbling on Happiness that I mentioned as well. So with these days, then, I mean, do you kind of self-identify, maybe not first and foremost, but with writing, you're talking about writing and also illustrating. I mean, where do you self-identify with the arts? If you had to kind of rank, you're a writer first and an illustrator second, or vice versa, or you don't think about it that way?
I feel like the reason that the way it comes up is sort of like, I feel like it doesn't matter to me that much on a self-identity level. I feel like it matters in conversation, and it matters with like branding oneself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I've been involved in arts and creative stuff since I was a kid. But I've always been really hesitant to call myself an artist. There's always seemed something like pretentious about that. And I feel like I'm like kind of coming to terms with like, okay, like I can feel like I approach a lot of challenges in life with kind of what most people describe as a pretty artistic mindset. Mm-hmm. And it's like, all right, maybe despite some of the hesitations I have about thinking of myself that way, maybe I should just like come around to calling myself an artist.
You kind of dodged the question. You didn't really dodge it. You gave the more, I guess, appropriate answer. But it sounds like you're saying writing and the illustrating.
I haven't. I guess one problem with that question is that it's kind of come to my attention through all this like self-analysis that our culture, we all like to build our self-identity and our sense of self-worth on the things that we do, and especially our professions. And I think there's some pretty big pitfalls to that way of understanding oneself. That it, whether your self-identity is built around your profession, your avocation, or like, you know, the fact your status or wealth or sexiness or all those things are like, there's going to be a time when that way of understanding yourself doesn't work anymore. And I think I've found that through my like kind of self identity as this mountain guy who like that identity seemed less relevant and didn't seem to be who I was anymore after my accident. But that identity got like replaced pretty much immediately by being like rehab guy, where I had like this, I had a very clear and present like next thing, the next phase that I would need to work on. And then kind of as the progress pace of my recovery has, you know, slowed down, it's like, okay, well, I can't be rehab guy forever. This is going to be, if my happiness is, if my life satisfaction is coming from like these, from like my physical progress and my progress is slowing down, this is just going to be like less and less, rewarding. Like that's not going to work as a way forward. And so, yeah, I think maybe this is what I mean about like dealing with things with an artistic outlook. Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't call myself a writer. I would call myself an illustrator. But yeah, I don't know. I'd say, I think the ways that I'm thinking about myself are in flux, and I'm not really sure that I have like a one word answer. Yep. So I feel like this super long answer just came out probably way more pretentious than just saying like artist.
No, I like this longer answer. 'Cause I think it's true. And I think that, I mean, frankly, I think it's really true, both in terms of how we size other people up and stupidly size other people up. I love how you're talking about you were mountain guy. And honestly, like, you kind of are rehab guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, how reductionistic is that? And I think one of my favorite things about these conversations that I get to have with people on these podcasts is people are never as simple as we tend to see them. And honestly, like, and hopefully we're not personally as boring or simple as, you know, how the rest of the world might see us. So I think there's something incredibly valuable in remembering that. And even if we sort of get introduced to people and can't necessarily know the whole story, just keep in mind, like, there's more to the story. And keep, like, God, please keep us from becoming entrenched folks that aren't continuing to grow and look and expand who we are and what we're thinking about and how we're processing and viewing the world, right? I mean, that's called like living a good life, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. That's really well said. That's really well said, Jonathan. You know, I think like one thing that makes me think of is kind of this idea of having a beginner's mind where you see a lot of, you know, where there's, you feel a lot of curiosity and you see a lot of possibility. And I feel like that's a really important mindset for mountaineering and for avalanche, being avvy savvy, where you're kind of constantly trying to look at things with fresh eyes, versus trying to be very aware of your preconceived notions. And I think I think when you can carry that mindset to other areas of life, like interacting with other people, that all kinds of cool things happen. Like that, I mean, I imagine, like that is the mindset you get to cultivate in yourself for doing interviews like this one. Mm-hmm. Like that you kind of like this intense curiosity about somebody. And I feel like there's all kinds of places in life that, I don't know. Life feels like it's a lot more fun when you're able to think that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't pigeonhole people or things or ideas. And Yeah, it's like not only it's not even that it's more fun, it's just more true. Right? It's both.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yeah, well, it's more it opens up a lot more opportunity for interacting, and it opens up a lot more there seems to be like a lot more serendipity in life. When you engage that way, I guess is my impression.
On that note, maybe we should leave off for now. I know I've kept you for a while.
Off to my Friday afternoon rehab session. I have this gym here in Carbondale called Ripple Effect, and the owner of the gym's taken a keen interest in my recovery, and she's been so cool to work with. And now there are a couple other people in Carbondale, a school teacher who was paralyzed creek boating last year. He and I work out together on Friday afternoons. And so this gym's called Ripple Effect. And so when Nate and I are in there, then we put a C in front of it and call it Cripple Effect. So I'm about to go off and have my go Cripple Effect for the next 2 hours or so.
Go Cripple Effect. Well, make sure you say, you know, if you're late, you know, you're late because it's my fault, and I'll take the hit on this one. But Jim, this has really been great. I really appreciate the time and the conversation. And Perpetual Weekend at Instagram is the place where you can see a remarkable trajectory. And I think you probably already have the sense that this is a pretty remarkable guy we've been talking to. And wish you a lot of success on the rehab front. It sounds like you need no good wishes on the illustrating front. It sounds like you're crushing it.
I just need to get my scene together to have make my art more available for people to buy.
Yeah. Consider this the kick in the ass, and hopefully we can all go look at more of the work sometime soon.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. Yeah, thanks for the interesting conversation today.
That's it for this edition of the Blister Podcast. Thanks to Jim Harris for the conversation, and to our strikingly handsome audio engineer, Justin Bob, who is moving across town this weekend. Good luck with the move, J-Bob, and I'm really sorry that I'm not around to help, because, fun fact, I worked for a moving company the summer before and after I started college. It was the second worst job I ever had, but I got to be quite good at moving really heavy things by myself, like washing machines. Anyway, till next time, head over to blisterreview.com to see what we're up to there. And we are already super excited to share our next podcast with you. It's another really good one, so subscribe to the Blister Podcast in iTunes or in Google Play to make sure you don't miss it.